Hi, welcome everyone. Today is March 25th, 2015. I welcome you to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and I open a public hearing on 3143. Robin, please read the bill.
Very good. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3143 directs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to develop model sign, including resources for victims of human trafficking, requires making sign available on departmental website, directs Department of Consumer and Business Services in cooperation with Department of Human Services to create sticker consistent with sign, becomes operative 60 days after passage, declares emergency effective on passage. However, there is a dash one amendment intended to replace the bill that allows nonprofit organizations to distribute certain branded and prescribed materials to Oregon Liquor Control Commission and outlets in support of disseminating information for victims of human trafficking. It directs OLCC to include materials in outlet license renewal packets, creates a sunset date of January 2nd, 2018, declares emergency effective on passage.
Great. Representative Whitson. Oh, and Kelsey Perry.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and committee members. My name is Gail Hildreth Whitsitt. I represent House District 56, which is the southern half of Klamath and Lake counties to the California border, so clear on the other end of the state. With me, I have my assistant, Kelsey Ferry, and she will follow me with a letter that we have received from someone who's helping us. I'm presenting a dash one amendment to my own bill, which is actually a full replacement of the bill. It's a gut and stuff, if you will, of a bill that was in effect in 2010, House Bill 3623, that Representative Barton had presented and was passed, and it sunsetted. And so we decided, rather than do something entirely new, we would just pick up where his bill left off, because it was a really good bill and the OLCC is happy with it, and he went through all of the process, and we just thought, why reinvent the wheel? So House Bill 3143, which is this bill, allows a nonprofit organization to supply the OLCC, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, with materials regarding human trafficking. This bill would prohibit the organization from charging OLCC for materials. In other words, we will find a funding source for the stickers. It requires the OLCC, if materials are supplied by the organization, to include a copy of the materials with each license renewal, and the commission will send these out for on-premises sales, off-premises sales, or brewery public house licensees. It allows the OLCC to determine if materials are offensive or inappropriate, and if so, they don't have to mail them out. But we have examples that I think they've handed out what the stickers are going to look like. But this leaves it totally up to the OLCC. There's no mandate in this. If they don't want to do this, if they find it somehow offensive, they don't have to. House Bill 3143 establishes that the number of copies that the OLCC sends out of these stickers not exceed the number of copies supplied by the organization and applies to license renewals on or after the effective date of this act. This program was passed unanimously out of the legislature in the 2010 special session, so this is just an extension of it. According to the United Nations, a little background history here, human trafficking generates $9.5 billion yearly in the United States. The U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 300,000 children are at risk of being prostituted in the United States every year, and that the average age of entry into prostitution for a child victim is 13 to 14 years old. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a pimp can make from $150,000 to $200,000 per child per year, and the average pimp has 4 to 6 children
working for him or her. The Polaris Project estimates that the average victim, sadly, may be forced to have sex from 20 to 48 times a day. So this is extreme abuse of anyone, and especially children. Human trafficking is a form of modern slavery that occurs in every state, including Oregon. According to the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, in 2014, there were 56 cases of human trafficking in Oregon reported to the national hotline. Of the 56 cases, 45 of them were related to sex trafficking. When looking at the top ways callers found the hotline, only 6 callers found the number on a poster. So this bill would seek to increase the number and bring more awareness to the hotline. So we're proposing that we send probably 6 stickers to each facility and put them in the bathroom stalls instead of like in a place that someone might see a victim looking at it to, you know, memorize the number. So when they're in the bathroom stalls, they should be able to look at the number and hopefully memorize it. With our renewed program, we hope to achieve greater visibility and awareness on the part of potential trafficked victims. Our office may partner with the nonprofit group In Our Backyard, and we're planning to send out stickers that will be placed in the stalls, as I mentioned. This is a way for the victims to gain access to the national hotline number, which is on it, without the pimp's knowledge. I appreciate the opportunity to bring this before you, and I'm going to have Kelsey read a letter from Nita Bells, who's the managing director of this sex trafficking hotline group over in Central Oregon.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelsey Ferry, and I'm the legislative assistant of Representative Hildreth Whitsett, and I'm going to read testimony on behalf of Nita Bells, the managing director of In Our Backyard. So while this bill mirrors the 2010 bill, I believe it has a greater chance of making a difference in the lives of those being trafficked in our state because of the type and placement of the sticker proposed. In most situations, when a trafficker brings their victim into an establishment, the only time the victim is alone without the trafficker watching is when they are in the bathroom stalls. This bill requires that stickers be put inside those bathroom stalls where the victim has some privacy to look at it and memorize the National Human Trafficking phone or text hotline. The sticker is adhered to the inside of the bathroom stall. This is preferable to having a paper for the victim to take with them because sex trafficking victims are regularly strip searched. If a trafficker finds a hotline number or text indicating the victim is trying to leave, it could result in their injury or even death. The sticker is adhered to the inside of the bathroom. We have been using the sticker for several years in Central Oregon. One of the survivors of sex trafficking who was referred to me from law enforcement for services told me that one of these stickers was on a bathroom mirror in a motel room where the pimp brought her to be trafficked. The pimp removed the sticker within a day of bringing her to the hotel room. However, she said seeing it gave her hope that there were people in the area who may want to help her. It is said that a picture paints 1,000 words. That is certainly the case with this sticker. Survivors of sex trafficking say that the picture on these stickers immediately communicates the message that help is being offered. It is my hope that this bill will be passed without opposition. It provides one more avenue for the victim of human trafficking in our state to know that there is help and to reach out for help. Washington State is considering a similar bill where stickers will be mandatory in all public restrooms. Please don't hesitate to contact me if I can be further assistance. Nita Bells, Managing Director, In Our Backyard.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a few.
Okay, Representative Starr.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for bringing up, this cause. It's very much a worthy cause. I sometime, I oversee a ministry that's called Act Southern Oregon Abolish Child Trafficking. And one of the visuals I like to give people when they think of that 300,000 children is if you picture Autzen Stadium packed out, that's a little over 50,000 people. So Autzen Stadium six times per year. Yeah, that's a lot of kids. So I absolutely see the need for this sort of thing. But I do have a couple just logistical questions on this. The first being that in the letter that you just read, it talked about requiring and mandatory. When I look at the amendment on line 14, it says that there may be a cover letter to commission licensees to urge that they post. So to my understanding, that the locations would not actually be required to post it, but
that's correct. We don't want to force anybody that doesn't want to do this, but a lot of places, you know, bars, restaurants, et cetera, that serve alcohol would like to, and so it is totally up to them to do this if they decide to do it.
The mandatory came from Washington State's bill, not ours.
Okay. And follow up.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. And I was thinking of, again, just another small detail on this, the postage, because this is pretty broad as far as tax-exempt nonprofit organizations being able to provide this. And in your bill or the amendment says that if it was inappropriate, you know, OLCC could choose not to send it out. Is there a limit, though, on the – could OLCC decide, look, 10 different nonprofits have sent us information – this is getting to be expensive. And so who picks up the tab as far as actually the postage of actually sending it out? And is there a limit where they can say enough nonprofits have sent us enough information, if you understand?
Well, it's our understanding that they're willing to do this, and I would assume that they will limit it based on what their postage is. So it's totally up to the OLCC. And so if they decide that they can afford to send one of these, then that's our understanding what they'll do. But we're making it available that if, you know, mm-hmm. if they want to do more, there are more. And if facilities want more, we can make them available. Will be produced by a nonprofit group. And so it shouldn't cost the state anything. We're concerned about that, too, that there is no cost to the state of Oregon.
Okay, and just on that, I'm reading just the specific language on. It seems as though the only out that we're giving OLCC, and again this is just from reading it just now, is if they deem it inappropriate. I wouldn't mind seeing some sort of a comment in here, or maybe you can show me later. Where in here that it does say that they can use their discretion with the number of things. I just wouldn't want to bind them because I do know, I mean, our organization, we tend to take flyers from five or six different organizations everywhere we go. And so I wouldn't want OLCC to get bogged down with the amount of things.
Yeah, we don't want to either. Kelsey just talked to them today. So
Chair Kenningeyer, Representative Stark, we are basing this program off of what happened in 2010. Mm-hmm. And so we will partner with only one nonprofit, so it won't be multiple nonprofits sending in. We're hoping to partner within our backyard. And then, depending on the postage, we'll send how many stickers we can. And what we did in 2010 was other nonprofits and volunteers actually stuffed the envelopes for OLCC, so it wasn't a burden to them. And we did talk with OLCC today, and they've been through this before, and so they are going to help us, and also Representative Barton, who spearheaded it in 2010, and we're just going to follow exactly what they did in 2010.
Great. That's helpful. Thank you.
Representative Taylor?
Were you first?
Rock, paper, scissors.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Kenningeyer.
Thank you so much. I was so glad when last spring walked into the room and the great good representative here from Klamath was in the room joining the CSEC group of us that work on sex trafficking issues. And I'm so glad that you are joining the group and working on this. And I know your assistant has been very diligent as well. And this looks great. I was just curious about something, is that I understand about having the stickers in the restrooms for the victims to have access to that information. But one of the other things I was thinking about was about, you know, just public awareness that it's going on, and if there was going to also be maybe a movement of having stickers, you know, in the bars and in other places, just simply stating that human trafficking is illegal, having sex with a minor is illegal. So here it says stop human trafficking. However, it doesn't say, you know, human trafficking is illegal. You know, if caught, you know, what will happen or this type of thing. Was there any kind of discussion about that, or this is just too new to start something like that?
Well, and I think basically we're trying to just have something simple so that when they take a look at it and they just have a minute or less or whatever, they can just pick up a number on it. But it's probably a good idea. We just aren't there yet. We just really want something that they can grasp the victim's a number and call.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks. Gail, did you ask OLCC, because they, in another universe, I used to be an OLCC provider, they have stickers for, like, you're pregnant, don't drink alcohol, and those are out in bars. And OLCC, I'm assuming, is the one who provides them, because they're pretty standard from one restaurant to the other. So clearly they have a mechanism for distribution of this type of, you know, placement of a placard. I mean, and I'm assuming they pay for it. I mean, it would make sense that, you know, it would not be that difficult for them to distribute these and get them out the door. Is there any thought about what they are currently paying for that program to get that information out there?
Representative Parrish,
video lottery machines, all kinds of stuff.
I had not thought about that. My whole goal, and Representative Barton's good advice, was make this as simple and low cost as possible so you don't get pushback, you know, by asking somebody to pay for something. So we're just trying to make it really simple. But I have seen those stickers, and I don't know, you know, under what statute they are, and if they or the, I don't know who makes them and sends them out. I have no idea.
Thanks. I just can't believe that they're that expensive to get them out and distribute. And clearly OLCC is distributing those to restaurants already. Right. So there's a mechanism to do that distribution.
Yeah.
That's good. Representative Hayden.
Chair Kennegeier, I concur with that. I think it's a very, very important issue, and if there's a couple of pennies on it, I certainly wouldn't object for the stickers, and I think that's a valid point. My question is, a nine-digit number is a little harder. We all know 611, 411, 911. Is there a barrier or a desire to get a shorter number, emergency-type number that we could possibly advertise, or put on billboards through whatever source of funding, whether that's private? Have we looked at a shorter number?
I can answer.
So
that number, Chair Kennegeier, Representative Hayden, that number is the national hotline. Through all my research I've done on the sex trafficking, it seems like it's just one standard number across the country. So each state doesn't have their own number. That sticker doesn't have it on it, but they do have it. They can now text, and that is just text be free. So that one's really simple for them to memorize. And I was curious about being able to memorize the number myself, but after looking at it on the sticker, it is actually a pretty simple number to memorize. So.
If I may, I think it's a great idea, and I had never thought of that before. I mean, it would involve setting up a system to, I assume, to answer or whatever, but it is really actually a really good idea to have a three-digit number that, you know, could become really well-known. I mean, it's a great suggestion for the national program. I mean, if there was some way to do that, I just think it probably would run into funds that, you know, we'd have to give more thought to it, but I think it's a good idea. actually.
Well, so there is, statewide, we have a 2-1-1 system. And almost every committee I go to, I'm constantly, every time I hear about the child abuse hotline, and some of you are in other committees with me, I'm like, why are we not using 2-1-1 that can link it? It's so much easier to remember. And the other thing is when the same people may have a different issue later on with seeking housing or some kind of subsistence, they've got the 2-1-1. So I would encourage that. I don't know that I don't think you have the number actually in the bill itself, but in terms of implementing this, I would encourage a talk with 2-1-1, and I'll make sure to get you together. Any other comments, questions? Thank you so much for bringing this
to us.
Thank
you very much.
Yep. Really important issue. Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on 3143 and open the public hearing on 2130. Robin, can you read the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2130 allows governing bodies to establish reasonable maximum holding times for land designated for low-income housing development. It allows governing bodies to elect additional criteria for exemption. It takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. There is a dash one amendment, and it requires additional provisions elected by governing bodies to apply to all. I'm sorry, I'm trying to read what. Okay. Governing bodies, it applies all the additional provisions elected by governing bodies to apply to all properties and all taxing districts within the jurisdiction. And then additionally, the provision asks that all provisions apply to additional provisions relating to the exemptions adopted by the governing body before it, and it's changing a criteria that before it only applied to certain criteria. So there we go. So,
okay, great. Well, hopefully we'll have that in English.
Yeah. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my apologies. The amendment is written in legal terms that I've gone two rounds trying to get in layman's terms. We have not arrived. So hopefully some very bright advocates can help.
Yes, we know that's going to be the case. So can we please have John Van Landingham, Mark Sanssouci, and Dorinda Schubert.
Oh, the law.
Yes, I know.
Like English.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think I'm supposed to go first and speak in English about this.
Your lawyer.
I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid. I'm primarily an advocate on landlord-tenant issues and affordable housing issues. I am not the sponsor of this bill. I'm here to explain it, and set the table for the folks from the City of Beaverton who are the primary sponsors of it. As I said, I work on behalf of tenants and affordable housing development. I have some experience with affordable housing exemptions. This bill amends two existing property tax exemptions for affordable housing. I have some experience with them at the local level in Eugene and Lane County and Springfield, and also here in the legislature. You have a letter in OLIS from Sheila Greenlaw Feek, who runs an affordable housing development project program in Washington County, Community Partners for Affordable Housing, talking about how important affordable housing property tax exemptions are to the development of affordable housing. They may make the difference in whether a project is feasible. They will certainly make a difference in how much rent the project can charge its residents. It's an important tool. Just emphasize that. It's also an important tool that is optional with local governments. So Robin used the word require, which made me flinch. There is nothing required in this program. It is optional for local governments. Local governments may choose to adopt one of these two property tax exemptions. You have heard a lot, I think, with regard to inclusionary zoning, about how few tools local governments have to promote affordable housing. This is one of those tools. In my experience, some local governments don't quite understand this exemption and have some reservation about adopting it. In my experience, I've been doing this stuff for a long time. I was on the Eugene Planning Commission for 12 years. I was on LCDC for 12 years. In my experience, local governments are not as wacky and wild and crazy as some folks seem to think they are. They tend to be cautious, and their lawyers tend to be even more cautious. And so what you have is a local government that may want to help with affordable housing, but feel like it can't impose the kind of criteria or limitations that will make it comfortable in adopting that exemption. And their lawyers are worse. So the point of this bill is to encourage local governments to add criteria that make them comfortable with those exemptions and, in my view, hopefully, have more local governments adopt them and help more affordable housing developments occur. In my written testimony, which is in OLIS, I've given some examples of that, and I'd be glad to go through that more. But just for you to understand, these exemptions are optional with local governments. They don't have to do it. If they choose to do it, and if 51% of the tax base supports it, then you can get an exemption for 100% of the property taxes. 51% typically means the city and the school district. Cities want to do it because they care about affordable housing. School districts often want to do it because it may mean more kids in their district. And that has an impact on revenue that they get from the state. So while it will cost them some revenue, we find, like the city of Beaverton, that some local governments want to do it, and we want to encourage more to do it. And this is a bill, which is why I support it. This is a bill that would, I think, help more of them do it. I'll stop.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Mark Sanssouci. I'm honored to serve the city of Beaverton as a city councilor and have done so since 2008. I'm here today in support of more affordable housing. The city of Beaverton understands that having housing at all income levels is critical for the well-being of our city, and the state nonprofit affordable housing development programs give the cities such as ours important tools, as Mr. Van Landingham has said, to help make affordable projects pencil out by foregoing our local property tax in exchange for the affordable housing development. Under one of the existing statutes, ORS 307-540-548, City of Beaverton passed an ordinance 2 years ago to allow qualified nonprofit affordable housing providers a 100% property tax exemption on land which they intend to develop affordable rental housing, or are actively developing, or have already developed affordable rental housing. When we passed the ordinance, however, we passed it with a tight sunset, and I'm going to explain why. The nonprofit affordable housing tax exemption program, as Mr. Landingham has said, is an opt-in program. No city is required to enact it. At the same time, the existing statutes, as written, do not provide an important degree of security for cities such as ours. HB 2130 amends the statute and the similar statute 307-515-523, which is another type of opt-in tax exemption program, and gives the cities the ability to add project criteria or program provisions, so long as they do not conflict with the state criteria that the project serve people at 60% of median family income and be developed, managed, or owned by nonprofits. Reasons for this could include meeting city goals for sustainability, meeting city economic factors, or just basically ensuring that the housing is built in a reasonable time frame. Currently, once an applicant meets the state criteria, which includes simply a declaration of intent to build affordable housing, the city has no ability to ensure that the housing actually gets built or that the developer remains in good fiscal standing with public funding programs. The only options currently available to a city are to sunset the program, as we've done, or to repeal the ordinance, or they can choose not to opt in at all, and that's not an outcome that I think any of us want. HB 2130 gives the cities the ability to add criteria or provisions to the existing program so long as they don't conflict with the state criteria. Last year and this year, just last week, Beaverton approved property tax exemptions for 3 affordable housing developments or projects. We like our affordable housing partners and hope to work with them and others to develop more. We would like to continue to grant these property tax exemptions as they help us help our lower income residents. And we would like to remove the sunset on our ordinance. With the passage of 2130 as amended, we believe we will have the security to do so. With this bill, I also believe more cities will adopt ordinances enabling these tax exemption programs and more affordable housing will be built. More affordable housing is really the goal here. The Dash 1 amendment provides two additional bits of clarity to the bill. First, it deletes some confusing language about the taxing jurisdictions involved, and in Beaverton there are many taxing jurisdictions involved in making this kind of decision. The same jurisdictions that approve the local tax exemption are the ones affected by these changes in 2130. Secondly, it clarifies that the additional criteria or provisions affect applications going forward and are not retroactive. So we at the City of Beaverton and I would like to urge your support of HB 2130 with the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions along the way.
Hello, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Dorenda Schubert, and I have the privilege and honor of serving as the Executive Director of Bridge Meadows, a nationally recognized intentional intergenerational community created to help families adopt children from foster care and provide a meaning and purpose to the lives of elders as they serve as surrogate grandparents to those children and those families. In this community, everybody feels like they belong and that they also experience many positive outcomes for health and well-being. But today, I'm here to ask for your careful review in support of HB 2130. As my colleagues have stated, it is would allow local jurisdictions to add criteria or program elements that are consistent with state statute, allowing property tax exemptions. With this, it would further the ability to provide much-needed affordable housing for our seniors and our families. It would create healthier guidelines for affordable housing projects that are unique to the different jurisdictions. The bill also helps more cities participate, giving organizations like ours the ability to create affordable housing. Without these changes, future projects may not be viable, and tax exemptions are a critical tool when we build affordable housing. It allows us to, with financing on the development side, and then when we operate, not having to pay those property taxes allows us to use those dollars to serve those folks who are living in the affordable housing. When a municipality provides such a tax exemption, it also indicates that there exists local support for the project, which we then can leverage to get other funders, private and public, involved in the project. Our board of directors and leadership recognize that a community such as Bridge Meadows meets the City of Beaverton's community vision, which is to provide more senior housing and to bring the generations together. We recognize that the cities should be able to have reasonable expectations of partners and to create more affordable housing. I respectfully ask for your support for the proposed legislation in House Bill 2130, because this will really provide us an opportunity to create beautiful, affordable, very safe, and high-quality affordable housing for our seniors, families, and children of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Evans.
Yes, thank you for bringing this forward. I have about four or five questions.
Go for it.
That's acceptable.
Okay. Go.
Okay.
Shoot one after the other.
All right. As a former planning commissioner, former mayor of a town outside the metro area, I have a little bit of questions. So, number one, what happens if a city doesn't agree to implement this system? Is there any, in this rewrite, is it a situation where LUBA gets involved and the city is on the hook because they didn't give this as an option?
No, bill does not change the fact that this is an opt-in program. The city has to pass an ordinance or resolution in order to implement this provision of state statute. If they choose not to do so, then it does not apply to them. The only thing that this particular bill does is change the levers and controls that a city can impose on the process if they choose to opt in. None of this would apply to a city that does not choose to opt in.
Okay, thank you.
So actually, let me supplement that, since I've been doing this for a long time. Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Evans, if 51% of the tax base, the jurisdictions representing the tax base, approve this, it will apply to 100% of the tax base. So if, for example, Washington County chose to do this, mm-hmm. It could do it countywide. Typically, counties have a small portion of the tax base, so that's why I said earlier it's usually the city and the school district. to get to 51%. But if Beaverton has other taxing districts in its base district, it would apply to them even if they chose not to. Now, that's a political issue that Beaverton may or may not choose to do. That's in the existing statute. If you don't pass this bill, that stays there. So they're not. This bill does not affect that.
So through citizen initiative, they could do it if they wanted, as long as they got 51% to approve.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Evans, I don't know what you mean by citizen initiative. This is not a land use decision. LUBA is not involved. It's entirely a tax, property tax issue. You know, one of the odd things about our tax system is that state statutes control property taxes, which fund local government.
But what I'm hearing is every property taxing district or government in an area, if they could get to 51%, they could initiate this process, or only cities and counties?
No, any tax, Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Evans, any taxing jurisdiction, any local government would include schools. I'll look up the specific term that the statute uses.
Because here it says
governing body.
Governing body defined here is city or county. That's
okay,
why
so
I'm
it
looking
is city
at school
county.
Districts.
Sorry, you're right.
School, potentially water districts, potentially fire districts, or is that?
So it would apply to them. They can't initiate it. It is a governing body. You're correct. It is a governing body, and governing body is defined as a city or the city or a county legislative body.
Okay. So does it take 51% of a vote, or only if it's for 100% of the property exemption? Could you do 75%?
Sure, Kennedy, Representative Evans. If it were less than 51%, then only that portion less than 51% would be exempted from the property taxes assessed on the property. If you get to 51%, it applies to all. If it's less than 51%, it only applies to those that approve it.
Okay. Follow-up then on that is, what other communities are asking for this change? Is this an LOC bill as well, or is this Beaverton specific?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Evans. I do not know the exact number of cities that have implemented this ordinance, and I do not know what other cities have stepped forward. I believe we do have somebody who's going to be testifying today from the League of Oregon Cities about this. I do know that this has not been heavily used yet in the state, and when we took a look at implementing this ordinance, we recognized right away that there was this concern that we had that caused us to implement the sunset so that we could make sure that we were not getting non-performing entities trying to participate in a tax exemption program.
And if I could supplement that, I think that there are currently five local governments that are using one of these two property tax exemptions: Portland, Eugene, Tigard, Beaverton, and I can't remember the fifth one. But so very few so far. And these exemptions have been in place since 1985 and 1989 for the second one.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I am quite encouraged by this. Affordable housing is a big problem in all of Central Oregon and Bend specifically, and there's been a lot of conversation in this committee in the building about inclusionary zoning, which I think is not a great way to address this problem. This is a community and public problem, and it shouldn't be just left to a few to pay for a community problem. And I think this is a much more equitable way to spread the cost of making sure that people have an affordable place to live. So thank you very much.
Other questions? I'll ask at the risk of sounding really silly here. I'm still trying to understand why you sunsetted something, and we already have this provision here. I'm still a little lost. I'm sorry. Like what this provision does that allows you to go forward. It just allows you to put more parameters on it so that you can be sure that you're not going to allow this to be used and not get the results you want. In other words, one of the things in it is a time frame, set a reasonable time frame. You can say if you develop it within 2 years. So what exactly? Like maybe you can run through a specific example.
Certainly, Chair Kenny Geyer. And I can tell you what the deliberations were that we had at the Beaverton City Council. Whether those would be held in similar fashion in other cities, I can't really say. The principal concern that we were wrestling with is that as the statute is currently written today, without any of the amendments offered by HB 2130, in principle, well, let's call them a non-performing entity, mm-hmm. could acquire land, mm-hmm. Establish a not-for-profit, mm-hmm. with the declared intent to create affordable housing, mm-hmm. apply for and receive a tax exemption because mm-hmm. the criteria basically say if mm-hmm. you have an intent to develop affordable housing on the land mm-hmm. and you declare that in your application, then you qualify. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to perform. You don't have to deliver.
Okay.
And you get a 20-year tax exemption under the statute. Mm-hmm. So we feel that the kinds of provisions that the city of Beaverton would entertain would be the ability to set a reasonable time limit on the holding of land for the purposes of developing affordable housing. And it wouldn't be 2 years. It would, 5 to 10 years would seem to be a time frame that many of these projects take. And similarly, it would be very nice to make sure that the organization that is proposing to develop affordable housing actually is in the business of doing so and has a reputation for doing so in a proper manner, mm-hmm. And that they're not a bad actor. The statute as written today really doesn't give us the mm-hmm. authority to deny the tax exemption based on our judgment of their fitness to serve mm-hmm. affordable housing clients.
And if I might add, John Van Lanning and Chair Kenny Geyer, in my view, local governments have the authority to do this without this bill. But as I said earlier, a lot of local governments don't feel comfortable mm-hmm. with that
right.
Because the statute does not expressly say that they can do that. Mm-hmm. I had this experience with Staten some 15 years ago in which St. Vincent de Paul wanted to build a project in Staten. They ended up getting enough money together to do it. You have to cobble together 10 to 15 different funding sources to do one of these projects. It's mm-hmm. very difficult. Staten asked its lawyer, can we cap it? We're worried about how much property tax revenue we might lose mm-hmm. by doing this. And that would be a problem for us if we lose a lot of property tax revenue. Mm-hmm. So can we cap it? Their lawyer said, no, statute doesn't say you can cap mm-hmm. it. I say, yes, you can. Who do they believe? They believe their lawyer, yeah. not me. This bill would allow additional criteria. Representative Evans has a bill also in this session that would expressly call out a particular criteria that the local government could add. Mm-hmm. Right now, the only criteria in the statute are income level, 60% of adjusted median income, held for rental housing, although one of the two is a little bit confusing about that, and it's either a 501c3 or a nonprofit sponsor that owns the land, or it can be a for-profit entity, mm-hmm. as long as a for-profit entity files an annual certification with the local government showing that it's passing through the benefit in the rents. Mm-hmm. Additional criteria, I've listed a bunch of possible additional criteria in my written testimony in OLIS, but they could include the ones that he just described. There are others as well. Mm-hmm. There could be one that says we have certain priorities that we've identified in our consolidated plan. It's a plan that HUD requires to get federal funds to do lots of things, whether it's block grant money or home funds. Your consolidated plan might have an emphasis on environmental sustainability. Mm-hmm. That could be, you could add that under this bill. You could have the certainty that you could add those kinds of criteria mm-hmm. as long as they're not conflicting with the base criteria. You couldn't say, for example, that we're going to make this available for people at 150% of
right.
AMI, because that would conflict with the 60%.
Mm-hmm.
And we're assuming, another thing I'd say, I'm assuming that local governments that do this are going to do this in good faith. They want affordable housing. I'm not right. distrustful of local governments. I want to make more of them feel comfortable and do it.
Right. That's very, very helpful. Thank you. And it's timely with the $100 million in bonds that we're hoping. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So the next panel is Eric Cantler. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a question for this panel?
Quick question.
Sorry.
Thank you, Representative Kindergarten, Chair Kindergarten. So I'm trying to scan through this quickly and didn't get to the amendments. Is there, like in our timber industries and stuff, there's a reach back. If the property sat there, for example, for 19 years and then got sold for commercial purposes for Walmart or something, is there a reach back on those taxes?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden, there is not in either one of the two exemptions that are part of this bill in the current statute. There is a requirement that you do annual certifications, and so a local government has the ability within that with that annual certification to say, what are you doing? Show us that you're advancing this purpose. But that's also something that, as he described, they want to be able to look at. Under the bill, I think the additional criteria that they could have would be to say, show us the progress that you're making on developing this project. And we're not going to let you sit here and hold this property vacant for 20 years and get exemption but not do anything. But there's not something that's I can't think of whether – I can't think that there's a clawback. But let me look at the statute while we sit here, and I'll come back.
And I get the follow-up. I get the criteria there. But what assurance is – because sometimes it takes – I've had building projects that take more than 5 years to get the permit, or in the fifth year finally after due diligence of working and working to get a permit. Sometimes they're very complex, working with different entities to get that to happen. So what assurance do those entities, particularly nonprofits or whatever, that don't have the funds to hire the big lawyer to push that through and just kind of have to wait it out, what assurances do they have that it won't be 2 years?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, there is nothing specific in the bill, and that is, frankly, a concern that I've had from the people that I work with, the affordable housing developers, who are concerned that a local government might adopt an unreasonable time period. And my response is, I assume that any local government that adopts this is going to do so in good faith and wants your project to happen and is not going to do this unreasonably. The example that he gave was 5 or 10 years. I think that before local government adopts one of these, the affordable housing community is going to have to educate that local government about the importance of the property tax exemption and the difficulty of doing affordable housing development. And it could take 5 years. It could take longer than that. There's one of the best tools is the federal low-income housing tax credit. The wait list, I mean, I think there were – the state administers those or allocates those. And I think in this last round there were probably three times the number of requests for the amount of money available. So you get back in the queue and hope that next year you might get funded or the year after that. So it can take several years, but to be clear in my answer to you, there is nothing in the statute now that says that the time period has to be reasonable, other than that the statute would say it has to be reasonable. Reasonable is an undefined term. As a legislative advocate, I use reasonable all the time in the stuff I draft, but it's not specific.
Is there opportunity to put some sideboards on that in an amendment, or no?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Hayden, anything is possible. I'm sure the advocates would like to get this through. And I should let Beaverton speak for itself. There's always a concern about whether amendments delay the process.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, I think Mr. Van Landingham has been very thorough in exploring the kinds of matters that we would want to consider as additional criteria. I think the difficulty in choosing a number for the time period is that any particular property or any particular affordable housing developer is going to have different characteristics, and those characteristics, in even with a given affordable housing developer and a property of a particular size, will also differ from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as to what the issues are and what the constraints are. So the time involved in accomplishing an affordable housing development is really going to vary not just from city to city but from project to project. So yes, you could write 10 years in there and it would be better than 20. You could write 6 years in there and it might cut a few projects off, or it might make it easy for a city to back out of a project that's a great project that's about to happen, but for some reason somebody's getting cold feet on it. I think that as proposed in HB 2130 with the amendments, we'll see probably some differences from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as to what those are, but I think most people are going to settle on the primary ones of looking for a reasonable time limit on holding land and proof of performance, a proof of progress, as Mr. Van Landingham has said, which is really the things we're after. We just don't want somebody to come and take a tax exemption from the taxpayers without doing anything. So that's the fundamental goal we're after.
One more.
Yep.
So let's say you've got 20 years, and after 5 years that a clawback would start if between the period of year 6 and 20 the project didn't come to fruition, that the counties would be able to, or the cities or whoever the tax base is be able to have that tax accrue, and they have a liability if they don't go through with the project.
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Hayden. I took that opportunity to read the statute or skim the statute. I think of a clawback as recapturing the property taxes that were waived or canceled, exempted previously. There is no clawback in either of these programs in the existing statutes. What there is a requirement that there be an annual certification, and once a project fails to meet those that annual certification, it's immediately loses its exemption. It does not get, I mean, it's gone. You don't get the rest of the 20 years. So if that happened on the first year, it's gone. Yeah. So there's no clawback of what got exempted in that first year, but it's gone, and you're not exempt any longer.
Thank you.
Representative Evans?
Okay.
And then I think all three of you, maybe.
Yeah. I don't want to give the idea that I'm not for this. I'm actually very much for this, that just from my own experiences, I want to make sure that this sense of certainty is understood. So in very simple terms, just if I can say yes or no, if this is right, what we're looking at here is providing a sense of certainty as defined as you can have more tailored goals, shared values of the community, shared specifics that are mutually agreed upon between the developer and the taxing entity. And the sense of certainty piece comes in that if those goals aren't being met or progress isn't being made, you now have a clear understanding or a clear expectation to be able to not certify something as a leverage to be able to make sure that it's happening the way you want it to happen. Is that a...
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Evans, yes.
Okay. Keep pressing. Great bill. I want to hear more.
Who's next? Representative Buehler?
Yeah. Give me a sense of how often this property tax exemption is used, for example, and how much, if you can give me a dollar figure, on the city of Beaverton that is exempt right now. Do you know that?
Chair Kennegeier, Representative Buehler, I did bring the information. I mentioned that we just did the second year of exemptions last week by passing a resolution at our city council meeting. We exempted property taxes for three properties. Two of them have been in existence for quite some time. The third one is in development right now and should open its doors either later this year or early next year. The note that we have in our council packet states during the 2014-15 tax year, the city of Beaverton awarded approximately $22,630 in tax exemptions to these three properties. However, that's just city of Beaverton taxes. It does not include the other jurisdictions whose taxes are being exempted, which includes the Beaverton School District, Washington County, Tualatin Hills Park and Recreation District. I think those are the principal ones. There may be one or two others as well. When you add all those in, a total of $105,159 was exempted for those three properties, which translates to an average savings of about $815 per unit for the year. We anticipate with good fortune and continued hard work that we would like to bring on another affordable housing project in Beaverton, ideally every couple of years or so. It does take some time. Ms. Schubert here is working on one that we are actively assisting with, and we have asked our mayor and staff to pursue with reasonable diligence the acquisition of more land in our city by the city so that we can bring on additional projects in partnership with either affordable housing developers that we are currently working with or other affordable housing developers in the Portland metropolitan area that we are familiar with and have spoken to about coming. So our intention is to continue to build this up over time so that we have a larger number of properties participating in the program. I just can't tell you how fast that's going to happen because it's dependent on so many unpredictable factors.
Okay. Follow up. Mm-hmm. And just to follow the line of questioning developed by Representative Hayden, why wouldn't you build in clawback provisions for when a property's had these property tax savings if it's sold for a profit that you know, for another purpose other than affordable housing, they wouldn't have to be caught up on that exemption?
Chair Kennegeier and Representative Buehler, In principle, we could do that with a much more substantial amount of legislative surgery. We were hoping to keep the intrusion into the statutes as minimal as possible and to just address the fundamental technical issue that we want to be able to establish the extra controls that the current language of the statute may or may not permit us, depending on whose legislative legal interpretation you're looking at. Clawbacks would make sense in the event that, in the instance where you find a bad actor who's trying to game the system and you want to recoup what has been lost to that bad actor. We don't anticipate that that's going to be a frequent case, and so I think from our point of view, it would make much more sense simply to do a minimally invasive adjustment to these programs and let us use them and perhaps in time learn more from that process.
And I get that, you know, a sophisticated, careful city like Beaverton, but what about other cities that don't have the expertise or aren't doing their regular certification? Do you have a sense of how many other cities are using this?
I'm Chair Kinnegayer, resident of Bueller. I believe that there are 4 or 5 cities currently using this. And I think I tried to name them earlier, Tigard, Portland, Eugene, Beaverton, and somebody else that I can't remember. So I would note that the risk of loss of revenue, the clawback, the abuse, might most likely occur with land held vacant for development.
Sure.
The other projects that are built have to file an annual certification, and right. So you're going to know pretty quickly.
Yeah, that doesn't bother you.
So,
right.
And additionally, of the two different exemptions, one of them allows application to existing housing that's already built. And that's an example that Beaverton is doing that with one of them. So for those, you're not worrying about vacant land being held for development. The other one does include vacant land for held for development, and that's the one where there is some risk. I haven't heard of that being abused in my 25 years of doing this advocacy. I think it is possible, and maybe someday when we rewrite these and make them work better, we should address clawback.
And the cities do the annual certification on their
correct.
Diligent
correct.
About that.
Correct. City, Chair Kinnegayer and Representative Bueller, in my experience, cities don't like losing property tax revenues.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Representative Stark, did you have one?
No.
Well, thank you. I was wondering about the clawback as well, or even setting up an escrow account where the taxes go into that, and then when they develop the housing, you can supplement some kind of provision like that. Is that really hard to put into this? I mean, wouldn't it just be part of cities, you're saying, in all the different things that cities can do here, and they can come up with clawback provisions, clawback or escrow provisions? I mean, it seems like why wouldn't they be able to do that now, in fact, but it may be the case that you were saying that actually there's nothing prohibiting them, perhaps, from doing that?
Sure, Kinnegayer, as I said, I have advocated that local governments have authority to do anything that's not prohibited mm-hmm. in these statutes. I had not thought about whether that would include going as far as a clawback. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to think about whether they could do that without specific authorization in a state statute.
Or how hard it would be to give right. to mention it in terms of all the different kinds of parameters that you can put on it, just adding that language so it's clear they have the choice.
So Chair Kinnegayer, if you look at the bill, I don't know if the bill
right.
doesn't have all the statutes, but if you were to look at all those statutes for those two exemptions, there's a fair amount of detail about the process for denying the exemption, mm-hmm. and that the applicant, if his applicant's denied, has some due process rights to get the information and have a hearing. Mm-hmm. If the exemption is later withdrawn because they're no longer eligible, there's a process there. Mm-hmm. So I assume we'd have to have some sort of process to allow the applicant to say, wait a minute, you can't just claw back my exemption. I've got a right to...
It would have to be set up in advance, yeah.
So I think it would be a little more complicated than just saying you can claw back.
Yeah, no, cities can set parameters around things like clawback. It seems like they'd have to set it out in advance. They can't just...
Yes.
Right. Mr. Sanssouci, I don't think you were here when we had the inclusionary zoning public hearing, but since you came down for this today and you are looking at tools, I wonder if you wanted to comment since Representative Bueller
gave his opinion of it. Is there anything you'd like to say? Are you the person on the city council that's really looking at how can you use various tools?
Chair Kenninger, I wouldn't presume to speak for the city on inclusionary zoning at this time because personally have not followed the issue as closely as I know all of you have, and there are others in our city staff and on, in the mayor's office who I think would be better to speak to that.
Okay. Great. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next panel, Eric Kankler and Aaron Doyle. Am I saying it right?
Eric
Kankler and Aaron Doyle. Kankler, is that right?
Kanzler.
It's 50-50.
Kanzler.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Kanzler. I'm here on behalf of the City of Bend in support of House Bill 2130. As has been stated already, property taxes are a significant component of the operating expenses for affordable housing projects. So obviously, exemption of property taxes helps to lower rents and make housing more affordable. Bend is not one of the small list of cities that currently implements the policies that 2130 would address, and frankly, as I understand it, it's partly for the reasons that have been mentioned thus far, that there's really no opportunity for local control, for tailoring it to fit the needs of the community, to address concerns about bad actors, and so forth. As you may have heard, and as Representative Bueller knows very well, Bend's rental vacancy rate is about 0.25%. And so we're searching high and low at the local level. We're searching high and low at the state level for things that make sense. This makes sense. I think the effect of this bill would be to allow the city of Bend and probably many other cities throughout the state to take a thorough, hard look at how this program could work. I don't think anybody could guarantee that they would use it in a particular way, but I think it would enable an honest consideration of the tool that is has been intended to be available for quite some time. I think this makes it much more accessible. So we're very supportive of your support for taking this step that would allow us to take a step at the local level and address this issue. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you.
Chair Kenninger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities, here in support of House Bill 2130. Two quick points, and then I'd like to address some of the questions that have been asked so far. The reason why the League is here in support of this is we recognize that all of our communities are struggling with affordable housing issues, workforce housing issues, some of them even executive housing issues. Housing is a very difficult issue, and the many levers which grind at that process only complicate the issue, and we're looking for simple tools and also more robust tools that can address those issues, and we think that this bill supports one of those potential tools and does so in a way that allows for flexibility for local communities to consider the needs and concerns of their own citizens and what they're giving up in order to gain affordable housing. And I do believe that this, by creating this flexibility to allow a local community to decide what the parameters of the program are locally, will create more participation in this program so that it's not that short list of five, we think, cities. Unfortunately, we don't keep track of all of the exemptions that each of our 242 cities have. There's just too many cities and too many potential programs. So it's not information that I have offhand. And we haven't done a comprehensive survey related to why you do and do not adopt certain programs. So I can't speak to all of the reasons why these haven't been adopted in all of the other 237 communities. To the issue of about setting unreasonable time periods, I think that there's two reasons why a local jurisdiction who's bothering to adopt this program wouldn't do that. One is they would have the local knowledge of how long it takes to get a building permit through their system and probably would be having a conversation with the folks who are coming in seeking these tax exemptions to know how long it takes them to get the financing together, because those are the two big delays to projects is once you acquire the land, then you need to fundraise to do all of the design and then building out, and then you're actually providing the low-income housing. And second, second is, of course, the building permitting process, which is something we, as local government, generally control that to some extent in the communities that do their own local building permitting. So I think we'd have a fairly good sense. And if this is something we're trying to incentivize by using a property tax exemption, we would therefore set reasonable timelines. I maybe not everyone agrees with the statement, but I find that our city councils are fairly reasonable when they're going after programs that they're trying to incentivize something that they need for their community. And as to the question about a clawback, there's a few reasons. I think, first, if we're setting the program's parameters, I believe there's the possibility that we could create our own clawback mechanism as part of the standards of the program that we're setting up. So if we're really truly in a community that's afraid that there's going to be a bad actor nonprofit running around collecting property tax exemptions and then selling it off to the highest bidder who puts in McMansions, if that's the big concern of the community, they'll probably look for some sort of tool that they can add in their own criteria. Second, I think that the annual certification process really limits the point at which things can run away from us as a local government. We will be looking at these properties year after year. So if suddenly the reports are, oh, they're actually renting to, mm-hmm. you know, Intel's employees who are not low income generally, mm-hmm. we're going to know that and we're not going to certify. And third, this is an opt-in program that the local communities are going to be looking at. And I think that by having the option being weighed at the local level, they can consider all of the things. Because like has been said, we don't give away property taxes lightly. We tend to prefer to ask for more flexibility with them more than anything. And so I think we're going to have attentive, dedicated city representatives and staff who are going to be make sure we're not giving away, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to receive nothing in return that we were trying to gain. We're by providing these abatements, we are basically purchasing low-income housing in a way. And if we're not getting what we're buying, we're going to stop buying and we'll end the program. So I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Representative Evans.
There are comments and questions, but perhaps for a longer conversation related to this. Mm-hmm. So, again, in Monmouth and Independence areas, I'm more familiar with. We do have our own building inspectors, and at least Monmouth does. So, the idea of an expedited permitting process, perhaps attached to a program that we're putting skin in the game for, might be something that could be considered as a part of the proposal, perhaps. But the question that comes to me is, right now that we're discussing nonprofits building these facilities, what about the possibility of a partnership between a nonprofit and a for-profit? Because in communities 10,000 or so, the idea of building a complex where part of it may be ran by a nonprofit, but another part may not be, so you're building capacity on both sides instead of just because the marketability in some places may not be able to support a larger scale development as a nonprofit for that particular clientele. Would this as written allow for those kinds of partnerships? I'm assuming it would, because it's giving credit, it's giving capability of the city to do that. But I just kind of want to hear for sure that we could.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Evans, I believe I heard Mr. Van Lanningham say that there is a provision for-profit developers who are that requires a pass-through with the rents if it's a for-profit developer. Is that here?
John Van Lanningham, Chair Kenny-Geyer, and Representative Evans. There are two different property tax exemptions in this bill. One of them is limited to 501c3s. It can be a partnership. In fact, there's express language that allows partnerships there. And typically, you see those partnerships with tax credit projects, federal tax credit projects. The other exemption is available to for-profit entities, partnership or not, as long as they show the local government that they're passing through the benefit of the tax exemption in lowered rents.
So that same percentage, the 60%.
No, the 60%, Chair Kenny-Geyer, Representative Evans, the 60% refers to the income level of the residents. That if you were to get a property tax exemption worth, I don't know, $10,000 a year, you would have to show, the developer would have to show that the rents were reduced by that amount of money.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm assuming on the 60% that if Representative Leininger's bill goes through, that allows it to extend to 80%. You have to be under 60% for rent, but you can stay in the building. Would that apply? I'm assuming that would apply to this.
Chair Kinnegeyer, I did help the proponent of that bill think that through. Mm-hmm. That would allow a local government to raise the 60% for one of the exemptions. It's the one that Portland uses, mm-hmm. conveniently enough, and after the first year. Mm-hmm. So, yes, a local government could go to higher income under that bill.
They still have to come in under 60%, but if they...
First year would have to be 60%, they would be allowed, the resident would be allowed, because right. We've talked about this, the annual certification, and if the annual certification doesn't show that the residents are 60% of adjusted median income, mm-hmm. the project would lose its eligibility for the property tax exemption. That's what's made PCRI, the requester of that bill, nervous.
Right.
So they want to be able to allow the city of Portland to make sure that they go up to 80% and still retain eligibility. Mm-hmm. So you're correct. That's
and again, that's something that a city can adopt but doesn't have to. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Since you've come from that far and you're working on all kinds of zoning issues, if you care to comment on inclusionary zoning, you've driven a long way, feel free. Our committee will be, we had a work session that we put off because we're considering an amendment, which is not ready. But if this is your opportunity, if you'd like to say something.
Chair Kinnegeyer, as was stated by Commissioner Saltzman during his testimony, the League is, of course, supportive of creating, lifting preemptions and allowing local governments to have the conversation amongst themselves. Inclusionary zoning is a complicated tool, mm-hmm. and each community should be having that discussion locally. That is a fundamental principle of the League of Oregon Cities, is that our local communities can make a decision for themselves through their elected officials who are close to their constituents and thus know their community and their community needs.
Okay, thank you.
Again, Eric Kanzler, City of Bend. I think maybe the easiest way to say it is that we're neutral on the bill. We've elected to take a position of neutrality. Do recognize certainly that you know, that local governments have their own unique sets of conditions, and it may make sense. That tool may make sense in some places, but our assessment of that particular policy mechanism relative to any number of other things that we could be working on is that it isn't the first thing that we would turn to. Okay. So,
I've got a question.
Yes.
From the League, why would you think that increasing the regulatory burden in the City of Oregon would be conducive to creating more affordable housing?
Terry Kinnegeyer, Representative Bueller, I believe what I'm saying is that having a conversation locally to make that determination and make sure that it is going to pan out, that's where the conversation should take place, is at the city level, to recognize what the city wants to do, what burdens it wants to and can't afford to take on, and how they would regulate is a conversation that the city council and those local elected officials should be having. It's not a version of any merits to or against actually implementing inclusionary zoning, but that the local government should be the one to determine what burdens they can and cannot take on.
How is a typical affordable housing project financed? You commented about the difficulty in balancing all the capital needed for these projects. Just give me an idea of if there is such thing as a typical project.
Chair Kinnegeyer, Representative Bueller, I'm going to be speaking outside of my recognized expertise because I represent cities as a lobbyist and I am not a nonprofit home builder. But I have also been in the ABC work group with Representative Parrish and I've heard from a lot of them. But my understanding is that there's a portion of financing the land acquisition, and then so you have the land acquired, you go through many different types of programs, federal, state, local, not-for-profit, to find all of the sources of funding that come together, and then and that's the traditional path of the nonprofit organizations that do affordable housing development, because they're not sitting on the cachet of cash, that they're not flush because they're not-for-profit, and so by having to leverage all those different types of funds and find matching funds, it can take longer than private capital might otherwise afford when you're working with a nonprofit. But I suppose I should let the nonprofit answer.
I invited Dorenda back, and I failed to mention when you were up here before, so it's a good excuse to have a question to bring you back, that Dorenda runs an incredible project that I hope especially Representative Stark has a chance to see, uniting active seniors, 55 and older, with in I think you have about 10 units of those, with about 10 units of foster families. So it's really, it takes a village to raise a child. And so you keep the rents affordable for the seniors in return for working a few hours a week, volunteering a few hours a week with the foster families. It's a fabulous model. And
thank you, Chair.
So maybe you can tell us how you put those pieces together.
So Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Bueller and Representative Stark, Dorenda Schubert with Bridge Meadows. It's a mosaic of funding, and it's not easy. It's a combination of public and private dollars. The public dollars are primarily the low-income housing tax credits that are allocated by the Oregon Housing and Community Services, and it's quite a competition because there aren't a lot of those around. And as was stated earlier, you can apply and be in and not get funded and have to wait till the next round that comes along. Bridge Meadows has been very fortunate that when we've applied, we've been funded in that round. Let's hope that happens on April 17th as well. and then it's a combination of the city putting in some dollars, and that can vary from city to city. Portland, for example, Portland Development Commission for Bridge Meadows 1 put in $1.7 million. And then this was during the recession when we created Bridge Meadows 1, and we were able to achieve $2 million in stimulus funding. On top of that, the nonprofit then goes out and does a private capital raise, and we, in the middle of the recession for Bridge Meadows 1, we raised $1.3 million, and we anticipate for Bridge Meadows and Beaverton that we'll raise $1.5 million, and it typically, for our project, it's about between $11 and $13 million to create, and as this dear lady said, we don't have a lot of money laying around, because our money goes to serve the people for whom we serve, and that's why this tax exemption would be so important to us, because then we can put those dollars, instead of paying property taxes, we put those dollars into serving the people and keeping them healthy and well, and not burdening other parts of our system. So it takes a long time, as was stated earlier. It can take a long time because, like I said, there's not a lot of dollars and you're all competing for them. But basically, it's a combination of public and private dollars.
Do you know of anyone using social impact bonds to finance these types of
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Bueller, at this point in time, the social impact bond projects that I know of have not been here in Oregon. They've been in other parts of our country, and we think that Bridge Meadows is a perfect program for social impact bonds because of the return on investment with taking children out of foster care and having them adopted, saving the child welfare system a significant amount of money, and keeping elders out of higher levels of care, keeping them healthy, and that they're also having access to affordable housing. The elders, they've been taken out by the recession. They have been taken out by a health condition, and they now have limited funds. At Bridge Meadows, we have people at a low income level for elders at 55 and older, and their average income is less than $32,000, and they are people who were there's a millionaire who's been there who lost it all. There's people with master's degrees. It's not what people typically think of low income when they think of low income. It's all of us one or two paychecks away.
I'd really like to talk to you more about that.
I would welcome that, Representative Bueller.
It's a national model. I think you were the second in the country, third in the country?
Chair Kenny Geyer, we were the third in the nation, and we have been nationally recognized. We've been on PBS NewsHour, and we were last week quoted in Forbes magazine, and in October we won the Eisner Prize for Intergenerational Excellence, which thankfully came with a $100,000 prize,
yes,
which helped us go to Beaverton.
Yes. It's very fabulous. Thank you. Well, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a lot of, you can tell, a lot of interest for it. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2130. I want to, again, note that House Bill 2564 was taken off of a work schedule today and has been reposted for April 1st. And we also had a House Bill 3080 by Representative Escoval, which he removed from the agenda because there's a similar bill coming from the Senate side. And so he's chosen to use that vehicle. Any other announcements? All right. Then I adjourn the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
Good day for that inclusionary zone.
Services and Housing.
Good day for that inclusionary zone.